All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to be focusing on, I think this is a really fascinating case from the Florida Supreme Court, Jenkins v. State. It's from 1980, and I think this case is super important for really getting kind of a grip on how final these appellate court decisions are in Florida, especially for all you law students out there. Understanding this stuff is really going to give you a leg up when you're, out there practicing.
Yeah, and I think the question that we're really dealing with here is deceptively simple, but it has huge implications, right? So under Florida's 1980 constitutional amendment, right,
Yeah.
can the Florida Supreme Court actually go back and review a decision from a lower appellate court if there's a dissenting opinion? Specifically, we're talking about a per curiam affirmed decision or a PCA. On its face, it sounds like a really kind of minor procedural detail, But when you start to unpack it, you see that it really unlocks a lot of important questions about jurisdiction on the appellate level.
Right. And to really figure this out, we've got a few resources here, some guidance on how we want to frame this discussion, a really detailed breakdown of the Jenkins case, and then just a standard case brief.
Yeah.
Today we're really trying to pull out the essential pieces of information about how the Jenkins decision shaped Florida's appellate jurisdiction. And we want to understand how this all works in practice, especially for all of you future lawyers out there. So let's kind of unpack all of this, right? So where did this whole thing start? What was the source of this legal battle in the Jenkins case?
Well, so it all started with Jenkins trying to get evidence thrown out. He was arguing that the evidence was the result of a warrantless search of his vehicle. And obviously that brings up a lot of Fourth Amendment concerns,
Right.
right? Unlawful searches and seizures. I mean, as you know, the Fourth Amendment is it's really a cornerstone of American law, and it comes up in so many different areas.
Absolutely. So what happened? Did the trial court side with Jenkins?
No, they weren't buying it. They denied his motion to suppress.
Okay, so then what?
Well, this is where things get a little interesting procedurally, right? Jenkins, he enters this plea of nolo contendere, basically saying, okay, look, I'm not saying I'm guilty, but I'm not going to fight the charges. But here's the kicker. He specifically reserved his right to appeal the ruling on his motion to suppress the evidence. I mean, that's a smart move if you're trying to challenge the way that the evidence was obtained.
Yeah, so the case keeps moving forward. So it goes up to the Fourth District Court of Appeal. And what happened there? What did they do?
So this is actually really important for the question of jurisdiction, the whole reason we're talking about this. The Fourth DCA, they just affirmed the trial court's decision, and they did it through a PCA, a per curiam affirmed decision. Just one word, affirmed. That's it. No real reasoning, no explanation, nothing.
Wow. So just affirmed. That seems pretty efficient, I guess. But hold on a second. Wasn't there a dissenting opinion in this case?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's where things get that's where things get spicy. So one of the judges on that panel, he wrote a pretty detailed dissent. He was arguing that the search of the car, it was unconstitutional. So you've got the majority just saying affirmed with no explanation.
All right.
And then you've got this dissenting judge explaining exactly why he thought the search was a violation of Jenkins's constitutional rights. And that's really what sets up this whole fight about jurisdiction.
I see. So Jenkins, he's looking at this PCA, this one word affirmance, and he sees this dissent that's basically saying the lower court got it wrong. So what does he do?
So he tries to take it up to the Florida Supreme Court, right? He's basically arguing, look, this dissent proves that what the Fourth DCA did, it clashes with, well-established legal precedent. And this is where we hit the big legal question head-on, jurisdiction. Specifically, what the Florida Constitution says about when the Supreme Court can actually step in and review a case. We're talking about Article V, Section 3B3, which was added in 1980.
Okay, so break that down for me. What does that part of the Constitution actually say about, the Florida Supreme Court's power to review these decisions?
The key phrase in that amendment, it's express and direct conflict. And the amendment was put in place for the reason, right? They were trying to limit how many cases the Supreme Court had to deal with. It was about giving the district courts of appeal more authority to make the final call. So basically, for the Supreme Court to have jurisdiction, right, for them to be able to step in, there has to be a clear contradiction between the legal rulings, the actual holdings of different appellate courts, or, maybe between a district court's decision and something the Supreme Court has already ruled on. So with this amendment, they were really trying to make the district courts, the final word in most cases.
So Jenkins is going to the Supreme Court, and he's basically saying, look, this dissenting opinion, it shows there's a conflict here.
Right.
He's saying that the fourth DCA's decision, even though it's just this one word affirmed, it goes against, you know, what the courts have said before about some pretty big issues, like what counts as probable cause and when you need more than just a tip from an informant to do a search. So on the surface, it sounds like, you know, it sounds like a pretty good argument.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems reasonable at first glance, but the majority of the Florida Supreme Court, they disagreed. And Justice Sundberg wrote the opinion for the majority. Their main point was that a PCA, that single word affirmed, it just doesn't have the level of detail, the express legal reasoning needed to prove that there's a jurisdictional conflict like the Constitution requires.
It's not enough for a conflict to just kind of, you know, be there under the surface. It has to be explicitly stated in the, like, the actual written reasoning behind the decision.
Exactly. The majority was very clear about this. You know, they said that dissenting opinions, yeah, they can highlight where judges disagree and they can offer some really smart legal analysis, but they're not actually the official decisions of the court. Only the majority opinion, or in this case, you know, the lack of one in the PCA, that's the official decision. They even quoted Justice Atkins from this earlier case, Gibson v. Maloney. He said, it is conflict of decisions, not conflict of opinions, that supplies jurisdiction for review by certiorari. And, you know, certiorari is how the Supreme Court decides to review a lower court's judgment.
Gotcha. So, yeah, dissent can be important, right? But it doesn't actually tell the lower courts what to do. So if the Supreme Court is going to get involved because of conflicting legal interpretations, they need to see those conflicts playing out in the actual rulings from different courts.
Precisely. And, you know, the majority in Jenkins, they also laid out some of the reasons behind their decision. They talked about how important it is that decisions from the district courts of appeal are seen as final, you know? And remember, a big goal of that 1980 amendment was to lighten the load for the Florida Supreme Court. If they started taking appeals just because of things raised in dissenting opinions, it would totally defeat the purpose. The Supreme Court would be swamped.
Right, right. So, we also have Chief Justice England's concurring opinion in this case, right? What was he adding to the conversation?
So Chief Justice England, he really wanted to highlight the historical context of this whole thing, you know? He was talking about that 1980 amendment and emphasizing that when the voters approved that change, they really meant to limit the situations where the Supreme Court could review a case. Mm-hmm. He pointed to all the debates and discussions that happened back then, you know, all the public information about the amendment. He was saying that the idea was to make the district courts the ultimate authority on appeals in most situations.
Okay, so he was essentially saying, this wasn't just about, you know, saving the Supreme Court some work. It was about fundamentally changing how the appellate system in Florida works, giving the district courts a lot more power.
Exactly. I mean, he was basically saying, this is how it's supposed to be now.
I got it. But then we have this dissenting opinion from Justice Atkins, right?
Yeah.
He seemed to be a lot more worried about the implications of this decision. What were his main concerns?
So Justice Atkins was really concerned about PCA rulings, you know, these one-word affirmances, and how they could actually lead to more confusion and less consistency in how laws are applied across the state. You know, if different district courts are just saying affirmed in similar cases, but they're maybe using different legal logic to get there, how can you be sure that the law is being applied consistently?
Yeah, I see his point. If there's no explanation, it's hard to compare different PCA decisions or to see how they line up with what's been decided before.
Right. And so Justice Atkins was arguing that when you have a dissenting opinion, especially when that dissent lays out a really strong legal argument for why the lower court might have messed up, that should be enough to at least get the Supreme Court's attention. You know, like, hey, there might be a conflict here. Maybe you should take a look. He thought the majority was being way too strict about what express conflict means, and that their decision could lead to, like, a legal system that's kind of all over the place.
So you've got this divide, right? The majority is saying we need to be efficient and district court decisions need to be final. But the dissent is saying, hold on, what about making sure the law is clear and consistent across the whole state?
Exactly. That's the tension at the heart of the Jenkins case. And you know what? It has real-world consequences. Mm-hmm. Because of what the majority decided, if you're trying to appeal a PCA to the Florida Supreme Court based on the idea that there's a conflict, you're probably out of luck if the PCA itself doesn't explain that conflict. It doesn't matter how good the arguments in the dissent are. That jurisdictional hurdle, it's still there.
So even if there's a strong argument in the dissent that the lower court made a mistake, if the district court just says affirmed with no explanation, that's pretty much the end of the road.
That's exactly what Jenkins v. State tells us. It really limits the power of dissenting opinions to get the Supreme Court involved when a case was decided by PCA. Even if a dissent points out really important disagreements with existing law, it doesn't mean the Supreme Court can automatically step in and resolve those disagreements if the lower court didn't explain its reasoning. So, you know, for you future lawyers out there, this shows how important it is to make your case really strong from the very beginning, at the trial level, and to make sure that any potential conflicts are addressed in the actual majority opinion from the appellate court, not just in a dissent.
Okay, so let's make sure we're all on the same page about some of the legal terms that are key to understanding this case. Let's start with per curiam affirmed decisions, or PCA decisions. We've been throwing that term around a lot. Can you give us a quick and dirty definition?
Yeah, so a PCA, it's basically a short ruling from an appellate court. The decision comes from the court as a whole. Per curiam is Latin for that. And it's usually just the court saying, you know, affirmed or reversed. They don't really give a detailed explanation of their legal reasoning or why they decided the way they did. They're meant to be efficient, but as Justice Adkins pointed out, they can also be kind of opaque. And as Jenkins makes clear, they usually don't give the Florida Supreme Court a reason to review the case based on a conflict.
Okay. That makes sense. And then there's that phrase, express and direct conflict, which is super important for Florida's appellate jurisdiction. What does that actually mean in practice?
So for there to be an express and direct conflict, you need two separate appellate court decisions where the actual legal holdings, you know, what they actually decided about the law, directly contradict each other on the same exact legal issue. It can't just be that the facts are a little different or that the judges disagreed about how to apply the law. The actual rulings have to be opposed to each other. And the majority in Jenkins really stressed the express part, meaning the conflict has to be clearly spelled out in the written opinions. So, you know, let's say one district court writes in its opinion that certain facts are enough for probable cause, and then another district court looking at very similar facts writes in its opinion that those facts are not enough for probable cause. That would probably be a clear enough conflict for the Supreme Court to step in.
Okay, so it's not enough for the judges to just have different opinions, right? It has to be about the actual written conclusions about the law, and they have to be directly opposed. All right, then we talked about nolo contendere, please. How did that work in the Jenkins case?
Right, so Jenkins's nolo contendere plea was a strategic move. It let him accept the guilty verdict from the trial court without actually admitting that he did anything wrong. But, and this is important, he specifically kept his right to appeal that earlier ruling about suppressing the evidence. That's a pretty common tactic in criminal cases, especially when the defendant thinks the evidence against them was obtained illegally. If he had just pleaded guilty without any conditions, he probably would have lost his chance to appeal that suppression ruling.
So the nolo plea was how he kept that Fourth Amendment issue alive for appeal. All right, last quick question. Can you sum up the big change that happened to the Florida Supreme Court's role after that 1980 constitutional amendment?
Sure. Before that amendment, the Florida Supreme Court had more power to review cases, and they spent a lot of time correcting errors made by lower courts. But that amendment significantly narrowed their jurisdiction, shifting the focus away from just fixing mistakes and more toward making sure the law is applied consistently across the state and dealing with really important legal questions. Jenkins shows how that shift played out. Under the amended Constitution, the Supreme Court's main job is to resolve those clear conflicts between decisions from different appellate courts.
Okay, so let's zoom out a bit and think about the bigger picture here. What are the key takeaways from Jenkins? One thing that really stands out to me is how the majority seem to be sticking very closely to the literal wording of the Constitution.
You're right. They really hung their hats on the word express in that amendment, interpreting it to mean something that has to be stated in words. And because a PCA doesn't have that kind of explanatory language, it can't be used to show a conflict, no matter what the dissenting judges might say.
And as we've discussed, this means that even a really strong and well-reasoned dissent can't automatically get the Supreme Court to review a PCA. The conflict has to be in the official decision of the court, which in a PCA is just that one word, affirmed.
Absolutely. And you know, that brings us back to this balancing act that we've been talking about. How do you make the courts run efficiently, which was a big reason for that 1980 amendment and for the decision in Jenkins, while also making sure that the law is clear and consistently applied across Florida? The Jenkins decision clearly favors efficiency and the finality of decisions from the district courts when it comes to PCAs.
So to put this all together for our listeners, especially those of you who are going to be lawyers someday, What's the main takeaway from Jenkins v. State? What does it tell us about how final appellate decisions are in Florida?
The big takeaway is this. In Florida, when a district court of appeal simply says affirmed in a per curiam decision, that's usually the end of the line if you're trying to get the Florida Supreme Court to review it based on the idea of a conflict, even if the dissenting judges raise strong legal objections. The Supreme Court needs to see a conflict that's clearly stated in the decisions of the appellate courts, and a one-word affirmance just doesn't do that, no matter how convincing the dissent might be. So this means it's crucial to be really prepared at trial and to argue your case effectively at the district court level, because if all you have is a good dissent, it's unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to get involved in a PCA case.
That's a really important lesson for anyone dealing with the legal system in Florida. All right, so for our final thought today, let's think about what Jenkins means for legal strategy. Knowing that a PCA can basically be the last word, even with a dissent pointing out potential problems, how should lawyers approach cases at the trial and appellate levels? And does this system, you know, the one we see in Jenkins, strike the right balance between efficiency and making sure the law is clear and consistent across the state? These are some big questions to think about as you move forward in your legal careers. And that's it for today. Thanks for joining us for another deep dive.